Hi, this is the Good Robot Andes, Season 1, Episode 2. My name is Andy Balaam, and this is...
Andy Cockerill.
And today we're talking about a film called Foxcatcher. But before we get to Foxcatcher, let's have a look at some of the correspondence that we've received.
We have some. Do we actually have people who are listening?
Several people cared enough to write to us. So,
wow, that's so very
we've got a comment on the... on the blog, which I'll read out first. This is from Farsi. He says lots of things. He mentions he really likes The Game, which I mentioned that I like as well.
Yeah.
And he also mentions The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Yeah. I'm not all that enthusiastic about The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, mainly because... there was already a version in existence that's perfectly fine. In fact, it's probably a better movie than David Fincher's.
Oh, of course it was remade, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Fincher's is fine, but why?
Yeah.
It's there to service an English-speaking audience. That's it.
And then he mentions a shadowy conspiracy theory about there being another version of Alien 3 that was suppressed by the forces of evil. You know anything about this?
I don't know anything about that, but just to go into a little bit more detail before we get into the show about Alien 3, is that Fincher sort of envisioned a different movie to the one that was released, and the work print that Fox released in their Alien box sets, that there have been several Alien box sets on DVD and Blu-ray, sort of addresses those issues and recuts the film and inserts lost footage. But I don't buy Farsi's conspiracy theory that David Fincher is going to spring an alternate cut of Alien 3 on us in about 20 years' time. I just don't think that's going to happen. But
sounds unlikely.
I could be wrong. In which case, that would be rather good, you know, if he does go back and work on it, that would be rather good.
Yeah, there's probably more worthwhile films to work on if you're going to...
I think so, yes.
Yes. Okay, other correspondence we had something from Scott, who mentioned some tech issues, which we'll get to in a second. Says he basically agrees with what you were saying about Gone Girl, although on his second viewing he wasn't quite so keen.
That's interesting, man. I haven't seen it twice. I should imagine that may well be the case. You know, it is a very slickly done film, and perhaps it doesn't have the rewatch value of twisty films like Psycho and Audition and things like that. Although, to be honest, Audition is not a film that I'd want to watch more than once anyway.
No.
But I think Psycho does have rewatch value.
Oh, yeah, Psycho can be watched as many times as you like.
Yeah, but Gone Girl, yeah, it'd be interesting to watch that again and see if it still has the same power.
Did you see 24 Hour Psycho, an exhibit at the Museum of Film in London? What's that called?
Museum of the Moving Image. Is
it called? Yes, I think it was that.
Yeah,
the one on the one near the concrete buildings in what's that part of the Thames called?
Is it the South Bank?
South Bank, yeah.
Yeah.
They had Psycho playing silently over 24 hours.
That's interesting.
Very slowly.
Ah. Okay, so they didn't repeat it constantly over 24 hours. The whole thing played over 24 hours.
They slowed it down. I watched a bit where she looked out of the window pensively.
Mm.
That took about half an hour or so. It was actually really,
was it?
Really quite good. But
spellbinding.
Some people were there for the night with their sleeping bags and stuff. That was hardcore.
That is hardcore. That sounds really interesting.
That was a few years ago.
If it gets people to, you know, say if they drop into the South Bank and they watch half an hour of Janet Leigh looking out of a window pensively, they might think, well, maybe I should go home and watch Psycho now, which would be a good thing.
Because it would be considerably less boring.
Yes, that's true.
We also had some comments from Edmund on our technical issues. So, yes, we did have some technical issues. Apologies, listeners.
Yeah.
He mentions that Andy didn't sound... Well, we're both called Andy. That's not helpful.
The other me, Andy.
That isn't me sounded a bit weak.
Yeah.
Which is fair. So we're trying a different mic today. Hopefully that'll be better.
I've got a Janet Jackson mic on tonight.
And he also mentioned the background noise, which there still will be some of, I think, but I've adjusted my mic and I'm going to be trying to mute. And if that doesn't work, next time we'll use a different mic, which for my videos on YouTube, I use a mic and I don't, the background noise isn't much of a problem. But for this, I thought I'd use my higher quality mic, but I think it picks up the noise. But I've turned down the input on that, so maybe it'll be better.
I think though what is gratifying about all of that is that although people have picked up on the fact that the audio was a bit rubbish last week, they are enjoying the podcast.
Yeah, although I've just realised that they won't be enjoying it if we start talking about audio issues. So instead of that, let's move on to...
That's a good idea.
My summary of the film. So the film that we're looking at today is called Foxcatcher. I literally have never heard the name before today. It seems clear to me that this is a film, a Disney's sort of youth live-action Disney film with mostly child characters, with Bill Murray in one of his less impressive roles. He's still good value, but it's not. There are some classic Bill Murray roles, like in Charlie's Angels. So not as good as that, but watchable family fare. Is that a fair summary of Foxcatcher?
No.
I'm surprised to hear that.
It's not even in the same, as they say in Pulp Fiction, it's not even the same game, let alone the same ballpark.
My problem with that plot summary really was that whilst that is what came to mind when you said the name of the film, I think it's very unlikely you would have chosen that film to do on this podcast.
Although really. If I had, that would be interesting. We could talk for an hour about how disappointing Bill Murray has been, and then
there's other films we could talk about in that. That would be good.
Okay, but let's not do that. Let's talk about Foxcatcher, which is what we're here to do.
Let's do it.
So Foxcatcher is an account of Olympic wrestling brothers Mark Schultz and Dave Schultz during the 1980s, who were their wrestling team. Called Team Foxcatcher, was funded by a man called John E. DuPont of the DuPont family in America, who were very powerful, influential family. I think they hold the patents to some interesting materials like Lycra and Kevlar and things like that. So they're incredibly wealthy family.
Hold on. This is a film about wrestling.
But is it about wrestling? So,
is it? Because so far it sounds like it's about wrestling. That's
okay, so there is some wrestling in this film, but really this film is about repressed male sexuality.
Okay, that's the only acceptable topic for a film about wrestling.
Because essentially, if you look at wrestlers, it's all about repressed male sexuality. We'll probably get loads of hate mail from wrestlers now saying that's not what it's about at all, but it seems to me anyway. So there's these two brothers. Mark Schultz is played by Channing Tatum, who is...
I've heard of him. Is he out of Buffy or something?
I don't know if he's ever been in Buffy, but he started out being in being basically a really good dancer in movies called Step Up. And then there's a whole bunch of sequels called Step Up to the Streets, that kind of thing.
Never heard of it. Why have I heard of him?
Well, he's pretty well known now. He was he's in the Jump Street movies, 21 Jump Street, 22 Jump Street. He was in Magic Mike. He's also in Magic Mike XXL, which is out now.
I don't believe that these movies exist. You're making them up.
Okay. That is possible. They have very silly titles, so I could well be making them up. He's an incredible physical presence. He's a big fella, and he's I think that he's very watchable in films. He's as a big, tall man in movies, it can be difficult, I think, to sort of make an impact beyond action films. But he's actually tried to break out of that and do stuff that's interesting and challenging.
And you would include this among them?
Interesting and challenging, yeah, definitely. So he plays Mark Schultz, And his brother, Dave, is played by Mark Ruffalo, who is probably best known to most people as playing Bruce Banner in the new Marvel Cinematic Universe. So he's Bruce Banner slash the Hulk in introduced in the Avengers and now most recently in Avengers Age of Ultron. So he plays his brother Dave, who is also a wrestler, but he's essentially Mark Schultz's manager. That's his real job. So Mark doesn't have a family. You know, he's kind of a loner. He's pretty monosyllabic. It's all about the wrestling. And Dave has a family. Dave's got a life outside of the wrestling world. And he manages Mark.
Mm-hmm. Did you say they were brothers?
They are brothers, okay. And they have quite a fractious relationship. You know, they're not, I suppose, as most brothers or siblings, they have a love-hate relationship with each other. And they are approached by John E. DuPont, who's played by Steve Carell, who was in the American version of The Office. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Yes, I've seen a couple of episodes of that.
Okay, so is he the
main character?
He's the office, yeah, the office, yeah. The boss of the office. So he plays John E. DuPont.
Mm-hmm.
Under very heavy makeup, so he's wearing prosthetic nose, and he looks very different to how he looks.
Why didn't they get someone who looks different?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I ask this question a lot of when they put prosthetics on an actor to make them look like somebody else, and you think, well, why didn't you just get someone who looks like John E. DuPont to play the role?
Hang on, this is based on true facts.
Yes, sorry, I should backtrack there and say that all of these characters are based on real people.
So, you know what we should also do? We should warn the listeners that there are going to be millions of spoilers all through this podcast.
We should do that. So as a matter of course, all of these podcasts will be highly spoilerific. If there's a stone with spoilers on, we're going to turn it over and expose it. No spoiler stone left unturned in this podcast. That was a very clumsy metaphor.
We're gonna tell you spoilers that you wouldn't have picked up by watching the film.
Correct. Yeah, we're going to delve deep into the backstory and the holistic view of the film. Mm-hmm. Is what we're looking at.
And I'm going to learn. You know, it's beneficial for me because I learn what I'm supposed to think of things without having to bother watching them.
That's true. That is true. So, John E. DuPont, who is, as I said, heir to the DuPont family fortune, he, for reasons really many unknown to him, he is a massive fan of sports. So he wants to fund the brothers Schultz for the Seoul Olympics in 1988, Seoul Olympics. So he wants to. Yeah, I know, it's crazy, isn't it? I actually remember those Olympics.
Yeah, me too.
I think what I mainly remember about it was that I didn't enjoy them as much as I enjoyed the ones in LA in 84, because that was really quite exciting.
I don't think I remember LA.
Okay. I don't think that's what most people say, actually. So he wants to pay for, he wants to sponsor them and pay for them. And he even goes so far as to install a wrestling practice area at his home.
At his own home.
At his own home.
In order that these two brothers can oil themselves up and come around and wrestle.
Yeah,
in his
not that room. Kind of wrestling. It's not. It's not oily.
It's the non-oily wrestling.
It's non-oily wrestling.
I've already learned something about wrestling.
There's more than one kind.
I didn't know there was non-oily wrestling.
No, and it's not Greco-Roman wrestling either, which I've also seen.
Because that's what they're into in America, isn't it? Greco-Roman wrestling.
Well, maybe it is Greco-Roman. Maybe it is.
I don't know.
He arranges for them to live on the estate and train and practice there. And he gets a great deal of heat or disapproval from his mother. This is a man who has mother issues.
Because all the money's come down.
Exactly. Yeah. And she disapproves of what he's spending the money on. You know, she thinks he should be spending the money on horses or houses or, you know, cruise liners or, you know, things that rich people buy, like speedboats and helicopters and things like that. And she disapproves of him.
So this is his form of rebellion.
Exactly. Yes. And his mother is played by the rather wonderful Vanessa Redgrave. Pretty much, you know, fantastic in everything she does. She's got a very small role in this film, but in every scene that she's in, you know, the scene crackles with tension at the way that she speaks to him, and she disapproves of what he's doing. But of course, as with all parent-child relationships where the parent disapproves of what's going on, that just pushes him more and more towards doing what she disapproves of.
You never hear a bad word said about Vanessa Redgrave.
No. And I actually think, this is my view, but I actually think that since the absolute tragedy of her losing her daughter, Natasha Richardson, and her sister, Lynn Redgrave, I think she's done better work since those tragic events. I think that, you know, she looks like a re-energized person, like she's, I don't know, putting those events behind her and sort of realizing that there's not that much, maybe there's not that much time left, and she needs to get cracking and do some amazing work. And I think that she's really done some fantastic film work since then. So she disapproves, but he ploughs on anyway. And there's a very interesting relationship between John E. DuPont and Team Foxcatcher. It's implied in the film that he, you know, he has physical desires for Mark Schultz. This is something that Mark Schultz denied after the film was made and denounced it, but then later on said, no, actually, I love the film. I don't know why I said I didn't like it, but he didn't really address those things about the physical stuff.
Okay.
So they go to the Olympics, and they do incredibly badly because Mark Schultz is basically falling apart psychologically.
Why is that? Because he's a loner and his life's meaningless? Or
There is that. There is the fact that he doesn't really have any focus. But there is also this complex relationship that he has with his brother and with John E. DuPont really affects Mark Schultz in a big way. This is not a man who can talk about his feelings at all, you know. And at one point, he binge eats in his hotel room. He orders pretty much everything off the menu and binge eats to try and throw a match because he's going to be too heavy.
Okay.
And his brother takes him and basically, you know, makes him throw up and makes him run on a treadmill with a hoodie on so that he'll sweat everything out of him.
And which will leave you nice and well prepared for your next wrestling match.
Yeah, exactly.
With no fluid in your body.
He's all done in by the time they get to the actual wrestling match.
Okay, so this is the thing with reality. I mean, things based on reality, right, that it's... There are all these events, but I can't work out yet what the story is, if you see what I mean. Is there one?
So there is one. So the story is that it's a story of the two brothers who are kind of they're sort of sputtering along in the world of wrestling. They're not really doing that well, and Johnny DuPont offers them a lifeline. But because they owe him everything, you know, they're basically tied into him for every single thing that they do.
Mm-hmm.
That affects Mark Schultz really badly.
Mm-hmm.
But he can't really articulate why that affects him so badly.
Right. So there's this power imbalance and he doesn't feel that he's in control of his life. He's spiraling.
Hence the binge eating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there is definitely a power imbalance going on there. And that's to do with Johnny DuPont's his desire to control, to control things, to be in control of everything around him.
But he, and his own, on his own part, has a power problem with his mum.
Yes, which he then passes on to other people.
Sounds miserable.
It is. I mean, this is, to be fair, when I watched this and afterwards when I thought carefully about it, it's very reminiscent of a David Cronenberg movie that he made in the 1980s called The Dead Zone, which is an adaptation of a Stephen King novel. And Foxcatcher.
I've heard of it, but I don't think I've seen it.
It's really good. There are not many. I don't think there are many great Stephen King horror adaptations. I think Stephen King's non-horror work is the stuff that's really good. But this one stars Christopher Walken and Martin Sheen playing the president. Actually, before he played the president on The West Wing, which is a bit weird. And I'm just digressing slightly, but I'm just sort of, maybe we should throw the Dead Zone in as a movie at some point. But Foxcatcher has a very similar tone and feel to The Dead Zone, in that it's very downbeat. It's not pretty. This is it shows real life in the 80s, and it doesn't show it with any kind of rose-tinted glasses or anything like that. And it shows the realities of being a sportsman or a sports person going to the Olympics. And the thing with sports like wrestling, sort of niche sports, is that they struggle for funding. So the fact that Johnny DuPont is willing to put up the money is a really big thing for these two guys. But of course they get in too deep with it. So Mark Schultz, doesn't enjoy being beholden to someone in the way that he is. And he loses control and tries to pull back that control by the binge eating. And Dave Schultz has a family and is more passive than Mark. He's quite willing to take Johnny DuPont's money.
Right, because it's not everything to him, right? It's a career. Someone prepared to fund his career.
Yeah, he's got a family.
So he's okay. He's okay taking the money and you know.
He doesn't really have a problem with it, and he doesn't really understand why Mark is kind of goes off the rails quite badly.
Mm-hmm.
Which of course does happen. So they go to Seoul, they go to the Olympics, and they lose. It goes really badly for them, which is, it's sort of like twisting the knife still further. They're beholden to this guy, and they haven't actually achieved anything at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So they go back to America, they go back to the estate, and Mark and Johnny DuPont have a big falling out. They have a big argument. As far as it goes with having an argument with Mark Schultz, which is basically he doesn't say much, he just kind of physically intimidates you and then walks out of the room. but Dave stays on the estate with his family to continue training wrestlers. And then one day...
Oh, so there's other wrestlers in this.
It's not just these. It's not just Mark. There's other people involved. Sorry, I should have said that earlier. But the other wrestlers are very much in the background. We don't really see them very much at all. Johnny DuPont approaches Dave Schultz on the estate after there's been some difficulty getting onto the estate. So Dave and his family are trying to get back on the estate in their car, and there's new security people, and they say, yeah, okay, you can go in. And John DuPont walks up to Dave and says, do you have a problem with me? Pulls a gun out and shoots him 3 times. Dead.
Right. It's based on real events.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he went to trial.
Mm-hmm.
He was found guilty by reason of insanity. I think it's likely that he got a good lawyer, the best lawyer available to get him off a murder charge, and was sent to prison and actually died in prison.
Mm-hmm.
So, which is unusual, I think. I think particularly our perception of of American justice is that if you've got a lot of money, you can hire a good lawyer and get off pretty much anything. And in this case, it appears that that isn't quite the case. And it is it's a real tragedy. I mean, there's a lot of Shakespearean elements to this story in terms of, like the two guys who are beholden to someone else and then it all going horribly wrong and then somebody dying. And it is a tragic movie. I should talk about the director, actually. It's a guy called Bennett Miller, who made a movie called Capote with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I've seen that.
I'm not sure. Philip Seymour Hoffman won an Oscar for his performance in that, playing Truman Capote. It's a very good film. And
isn't he kind of unbearable in it?
Yes, he is, but I think Truman Capote was kind of unbearable in real life.
Yeah, I think that might be the point. Yeah, I don't think I've seen it. I think I've heard about it.
But there is another Truman Capote film. This is kind of unrelated, but kind of related anyway, called Infamous, with Toby Jones playing Truman Capote, which I found to be more palatable in terms of the character of Truman Capote being less annoying. But I did think that in the film Capote with Philip Seymour Hoffman, his performance was really good.
Mm-hmm.
It was very, very good. So Bennett Miller knows how to get good performances out of actors, and particularly with taking people like Channing Tatum and Steve Carell, who you wouldn't automatically think would be perfect fits for this kind of material.
Okay.
He takes these guys and he pushes them hard. You know, Channing Tatum has said in the interview that this film was the most difficult thing he's ever had to do. But it doesn't show. You know, it looks like it comes naturally to him, this kind of thing. And Steve Carell was nominated for an Academy Award for his performance. And he isn't unrecognizable under the prosthetics, but his performance is unlike anything I've ever seen him do before. You know, it's creepy and manipulative and power hungry and all of these things. And it's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And
I think maybe we're getting towards, I was going to ask you what you like about it, because it just sounds depressing. But I guess the performances are
what makes it. Right. So it's not a complicated story. You know, it doesn't have twists and turns like the film we reviewed last week, Gone Girl. It doesn't have those twists and turns. You know, it's a pretty linear plot line. It doesn't move around in time. But what is great about it is the performances. You know, this is a throwback. I think on my radio show, I drew a line between this and 1970s and 80s films like All the President's Men, and The Verdict and things like that, which are very serious performance-driven films. And this is of that kind of thing.
That makes me think about, what's the one where The Whistleblower? Is it called The Whistleblower? Or?
Yeah, yeah.
It took itself very seriously. It's got someone in it.
Yeah, this film does take itself very seriously. And it's set during the 1980s and then later on, the 1990s, and it even, you know, Bennett Miller's even gone so far as to make it look like it was made in the 1980s. So there's lots of static cam. There's no wobbly cam in this.
Oh, again, dear.
I've picked another film with no wobbly cam in it.
Perhaps we should address that.
I think we probably should.
So something that we as a society are currently telling ourselves is that the 80s is... The 80s was a time of kind of venal capitalism that we're in some sense past, which that's the bit I'm skeptical of. But it sounds to me like that fits in with that current view we have of the 80s.
Yes. So
being all about money.
Sorry, it's not all about money.
And about that the 80s was all about money.
Yeah, so... That is the driving plot, is that Johnny DuPont can buy anything he wants, including people, basically.
And he does it, and it kind of doesn't work out very well, but
it doesn't work out very well. I mean, the reasons for him shooting Dave Schultz are never really explored. So you can kind of think about all kinds of reasons why that would be. It could be that an event happens that I hadn't talked about yet, was that his mother does die, which affects him very, very badly indeed, because, you know, we go back to the complicated relationship between domineering parents and children, and there was so much that he left was left unsaid between him and his mother that it could no longer be resolved. And he withdraws into himself and becomes paranoid, and that is the driving force between the break between him and Mark Schultz, and then ultimately the shooting of Dave Schultz.
Potentially unsatisfying factor in something based on real life is that things aren't necessarily easily explained. You know, like, so exactly why he did it.
Yeah,
may not be clear.
That's right, and I think actually that ambiguity is important in this film, because unlike so many films that have a sort of Basil exposition type character who tells you exactly what's going on all the time, what everybody's thinking, what they're feeling, why they're doing things, what's my motivation for shooting this man? You know, I just need a motivation. Don't really need to know that. The act when it happens is so shocking and abrupt.
Did you have any idea it was coming?
No.
No idea at all.
Idea at all. It comes out of nowhere. And when it happens, it's so shocking that it the kind of shock of what happens bleeds into the next scene. And I had to take a moment, because I watched it at home on Blu-ray, I had to take a moment to just think, okay, what did I just see?
Does it then follow the trial and stuff?
No, or, you know, it doesn't.
Where does it end?
The film ends very soon after that and tells you what happened afterwards.
So it just
titles.
Yeah. Okay. That fits the Shakespearean tragedy thing, right? It all just gradually gets worse, and then someone dies.
Yeah, I mean, if we look at any great Shakespearean tragedy, when the hero or anti-hero or victim is killed, usually the play ends pretty soon after that.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, the end of Hamlet. Oh, here's a spoiler. Spoil the end of Hamlet.
I think we should do our best to spoil as many films as possible. I mean, I include plays in that.
Everyone dies at the end of Hamlet.
I once saw
Macbeth gets beheaded, that kind of thing. So,
I once saw Hamlet with the man I hate.
That's a long list.
Which was cut down. You know who I mean? The one out of Frankenstein and everything else.
One out of Frankenstein. Frankenstein.
Movie? All right, that's a misleading.
Kenneth Branagh. You hate Kenneth Branagh.
Although he did make a pretty good Valander.
Yeah, Valander's good, isn't it?
I particularly hate Kenneth Branagh doing Shakespeare. And I was forced to attend a 4-hour. It was cut down to 4 hours. Hamlet that I saw at the theatre. It was agony.
He subsequently made a movie version of Hamlet that's also is uncut and goes on forever.
You know what's worse than watching Hamlet? It's listening to someone talk about how honoured they were to be cast as Hamlet.
We're going to have to differ on the Kenneth Branagh thing. I'm kind of with you on his theatrical work, but I do really like him as a film director.
What did he direct? There's something I liked, I think.
Of late, he's made... he made a film called Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit, which is a sort of reboot of the Jack Ryan movies, you know, the ones with the Hunt for Red October and Clear and Present Danger and...
Right, I think I saw Clear and Present Danger.
Okay, so this Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit is a reboot of that character.
Okay.
With Chris Pine, who's in Star Trek as Captain Kirk, and... Keira Knightley and Kenneth Branagh playing a Russian mobster and doing it very well.
As he's got older and he's played characters that are a bit grumpier, I think I like him more. Have you seen any of the Valander that he did?
Yeah, I think he's amazing.
He's really good in that, yeah.
Yeah, He really is good. So,
and that kind of vulnerability along with grumpiness that he can do is...
Yes, exactly.
Very effective.
So, yes, Foxcatcher is an unhappy film. It's an unhappy film about unhappy people. You know, I can't remember any moments in this film where anybody cracks a funny or looks like they're having a good time. You know, it's...
But how does it make you care then? I mean, I so far...
Okay.
I can't remember.
How does it make you care? Well, it makes you care because you want to know what's going to happen. But these characters are not easy to love. That is true.
Mm-hmm.
They are not easy to love. Bennett Miller doesn't go out of his way to sugarcoat them in any way whatsoever. It's and in that respect, I think it's a very brave film because you can alienate an audience by not portraying people as likable or sympathetic.
Yeah, I mean, there has to be some other reason to watch then. The simplest reason to watch is because you want someone to be
it's
all right.
In this movie, it's all about the performances.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's it. I mean, the in terms of, you know, feeling empathy for any of these people, it's really difficult to do that. I mean, you feel a certain... That's not true. I suppose you do feel a certain sense of empathy for Mark Schultz and his situation, but he's so emotionally closed down that it's hard to... excuse me, it's hard to empathise with him very much.
It's possible that... that you can feel empathy with him if you've, you know... If you feel that you also find it difficult to express your emotions or deal with your emotions, then you can imagine empathizing with him, even if you didn't like him.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't deal with anything really. I mean, Channing Tatum, as you know, when you see him being interviewed and seeing him in films other than this one, he's a very engaging screen presence. You know, he's a very engaging interview subject. He talks candidly about everything that people ask him about. And, you know, he's a very fine actor and he's got a great screen presence about him. And in this film, he's, you know, a polar opposite from anything he's ever done before. He's a hulking presence who looks like at any moment he's about to explode with rage.
Mm.
It's
I can imagine that's quite, I was going to say fun to watch, but you know what I mean? It like keeps you watching.
It's quite compelling. Yeah, he is a compelling presence. I mean, when other actors are in the foreground and he's in the background, you're still watching him to see what he's going to do because he's such a presence. And performance-wise, you know, Mark Ruffalo is very, very good. You know, he's an actor who's been around for a long time. And, you know, this film gives him the chance to, you know, really stretch his acting muscles and really go for it. But for me, the two standouts are Steve Carell and Channing Tatum. You know, Steve Carell is really creepy, really, really creepy. Also, a special note for an actress called Sienna Miller, who I first saw in a Matthew Vaughn movie called Layer Cake.
I've heard of her. I think I've seen Layer Cake, but I think I've heard of her
with Daniel Craig.
Yeah,
Michael Gambon, which I really enjoyed, and she plays.
Looked like the packaging of it made it look like it was going to be awful, and actually it was better than it looked.
Yeah, it's a good movie, and she plays in that, you know, a very glamorous woman, and in this she plays Dave Schultz's pretty, you know, busy and very dowdy looking wife. And I didn't actually realize until the credits rolled that it was Sienna Miller.
Right.
And she's really, really good. You know, she's, she's underplaying it. And in that respect, okay, so there's another parallel here between, you know, some films that we really like, which are things like Goodfellas and Raging Bull, where you can tell that everybody is absolutely on their game and there's nobody who's not giving a fantastic performance. And Foxcatcher feels like that. You know, this is a film that's all about performances.
The actors are suffering with the characters.
Yeah, it looks like they're living it from day to day.
There's misery everywhere.
Yeah, Exactly.
So you mentioned near the beginning, I can't remember the phrase you used, or did you say it was about male, repressed male sexuality, okay, or repressed,
so, yes,
something?
Yeah, you said this is about wrestling, and but I don't think it is. I think that it's, wrestling is what drives the plot, but actually it's about, sons having issues with their mothers,
mm-hmm,
and men having issues with other men with repressed sexuality. And, you know, John E. DuPont is a man who's never had to fight for anything. He's had to want for anything. He can have whatever he wants, regardless of whether his mother agrees with what he's doing or not. He can do whatever he wants. And because of that, that's made him quite a screwed up individual.
Mm, and he hasn't managed to have a good relationship, a relationship that he's happy with.
Yeah, exactly. So, and he doesn't, I suppose, like so many relationships between, the person who's in charge and the subordinate, he starts to think that Mark and Dave Schultz are his friends.
Right. Yeah.
When actually they're
kind
not.
Of, he's kind of bought them as friends, hasn't he?
Yeah. They're like paid for friends, but they don't see him that way at all. And that's what, that's what causes the whole thing to start to fall apart.
And that, you can see that if you come to a full understanding of that, you can see how that could motivate murder if you...
Yes.
I'm not saying that I would murder someone in that situation, but...
No, I don't think you would.
I'm not saying that.
I don't think you would ever murder anyone, ever. But...
unless I found out they weren't my friend.
Well, quite, yes. Should we stop talking about murdering people now?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so
I've got 10 minutes of material prepared on it.
Oh no, really?
No.
We can put it in the podcast extras, and then.
Oh, are there podcast extras?
I have no idea. I'm just putting. Okay, outtakes. Yeah. So yes, you can definitely see how a man like John E. DuPont, who's never had to fight for anything, never had to work for anything, has always had everything given to him on a plate, could become paranoid and distraught and think that everyone's out to get him, and then commit murder.
And what about Mark? What's going on with him? Or do we really not know?
We don't know what happened to Mark. You don't. So the film ends with Mark competing in a cage fight during the 1990s, which mm-hmm. is a particularly unpleasant form of sort of all-in wrestling where anything goes. So that's what he's been reduced to.
Not a brilliant career choice, cage fighting.
No, not at all. Very good movie about cage fighting, though, called Warrior, with Tom Hardy and... Joel Edgerton, featuring a fantastic performance by an incredibly eccentric Nick Nolte.
All right.
That's a very fine film.
Who's Nick Nolte? I know that name.
Nick Nolte's been in a lot of stuff. I think probably lately he's probably more famous for Raising Hell, although he's always been famous for Raising Hell to a certain extent. Nick Nolte, what's a really great part? Did you see the Ang Lee version of the Hulk? It's called Hulk, I think it was called. He played David Banner's father in that.
Right, okay.
He gives a very fine performance in that. Anyway, so that's Warrior. I think that's all I have to say about Foxcatcher.
So I want this question resolved about Mark. During the movie, do we have any idea what's motivating him? Is the repressed male sexuality thing that you said, is that about, what's his name, the rich guy, or is it also about Mark and his brother?
Well, Mark's sexuality is never addressed. In fact, nobody's sexuality is ever really addressed. It's implied. So, we don't know whether Mark... is straight or gay or bisexual or anything like that. We assume that Dave Schultz is, he's a family man, but that doesn't really mean anything. Johnny DuPont doesn't have a partner. So we have no idea, really. It's very ambiguous. And I think
there are three men who, and these relationships really matter to them, be they friendships or you know, some kind of sexual attraction. They really matter, and it goes wrong.
Yeah. They're very driven. They're all driven alpha males.
Right.
And if you get those three driven alpha males in a room together, you are going to get some sparks and friction. And that is what happens.
Okay. So the standard question, what's the point of this film?
What's the point of this film? Well, it sheds some light on a historic, you know, historical event, a sporting event that I wasn't previously aware of at all, which was very interesting. You know, the sport of wrestling, which I really know nothing about beyond the fact that I used to watch wrestling on ITV during the 1970s and 80s and used to enjoy that.
I think it was rather different, though, presumably.
Yes, yes. I think that was entertainment. This is the real thing. What else is it for? It's also it's some very, very fine performances. So it delivers on that front. Aesthetically pleasing to look at, you know, artistically rather good.
Does it increase your human empathy? You know, living the with these characters and seeing them suffer.
I think it teaches you that you need to talk about your stuff. If you have stuff going on that could potentially be a problem, that you should probably talk to somebody about it.
Instead of shooting people, you might pull out
a gun and shoot someone.
Okay, because, so don't talk about your problems. Yeah. No,
go talk about your problems.
Do talk about your problems. Don't shoot people.
Don't shoot people.
Okay.
Be nice. As Bill and Ted, as this podcast references, be excellent to each other.
Yeah, and don't shoot people.
Yeah, don't shoot people.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that seems worth knowing. I must say, you haven't sold me on it the way you sold me on Gone Girl.
Okay.
I think it sounds like it's a good film, but maybe not a very enjoyable film.
I think to put that into perspective, Gone Girl is a very flashy mainstream thriller, and Foxcatcher is probably at the other end of the spectrum. So it's unflashy, not particularly mainstream,
mm-hmm.
and it's all about the performances, whereas Gone Girl is all about the style.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as with most things that David Finch has made, it's very stylish and slick. Which is a good thing for Gone Girl because it did incredibly well, and it already had an audience in that the fans of the book. Actually, we need to talk about that. The author of the book of Gone Girl,
mm-hmm.
We had a discussion last week about this. It is Gillian. She is. Yeah. She likes to be pronounced as Gillian Flynn.
Yes, I accept that. But I continue to feel that that's an extremely unlikely pronunciation for that name.
This is what she says. She might just be saying that to wind you up.
Yeah, I think she may be misinformed.
Okay. Should I ever meet her, which I never will, I'll pass that on.
Okay, yeah, and I will do likewise when I meet her.
So I think, you know, to sum up, it's not Foxcatcher is not flashy. It's all about the performances.
Yeah, it sounds rather worthy.
Do you mean worthy in a bad way or a good way? Worthy in a bad way.
Worthy in a good way, let's say.
It's worthy in a good way. It's not po-faced and humourless.
Right,
although
right.
I did say that there aren't many laughs in it, but it's not really about comedy. You know, it doesn't take itself so seriously that it alienates you. No, it does draw you in, and it does make you want to know what's going to happen next.
I think if I were tricked into watching it, I would come out of it a better person.
Possible, yes.
And I don't think I would regret watching it, but I think it would be quite hard to persuade me to start watching it. That's what I suspect.
Yeah, it is a long movie, and in terms of sort of engaging you and drawing you in, it's a tough watch. Yeah, tough watch.
Great, thank you for letting us know. Okay, so do we have ideas of what we might do next time? We mentioned something last time, which we're now not doing. So what?
In our correspondence, Scott suggested that we do something.
He did, yeah. He suggested Nightcrawler.
That is an excellent subject for the next talk.
Excellent. So maybe Nightcrawler. So, one day maybe Far From the Madding Crowd?
Oh, definitely. No, we should talk about those. In fact, we should also talk about, at some point in the future, I watched for the first time last night on Blu-ray, Dr. Zhivago.
Ah, don't tell me anything about it.
Okay. Won't tell you anything, but I watched that for the first time, a restored Blu-ray, which looked absolutely stunning.
Cool. We can definitely do that. I also think we should do Mad Max.
The original
Mad Max? The new Mad Max.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that.
So that would be good. I know you really like that, and I've heard a bit too much about it, but on the other hand, we'll have the bonus effect of one day I will probably watch that, so I can report back on whether I thought what I was supposed to think after I've watched it.
Okay, so we've got a whole bunch of stuff there that we want to talk about next time. I think we should maybe not announce that until the next podcast, what we're going to do. Keep them keen, as they say.
Yeah. Well, in that case, there will be something which may or may not have been just mentioned in the next podcast.
Indeed.
Thank you very much, Andy. See you next time.
Thank you. Bye.